Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking underneath the hood of the AI revolution.
That's right. We're not really talking about the cool apps or the algorithms today.
No, we're going way deeper, down to the absolute physical foundations of the entire digital economy.
We're talking processing, storage, communication, and crucially, electrical power, the real building blocks.
And how artificial intelligence, especially training these massive models, is putting an unprecedented stress test on all of it.
Exactly. You know, for a long time, we thought of the digital world as sort of abstract, right? Code, clouds, intangible stuff.
Yeah, almost weightless.
But AI has pulled back the curtain. It shows us this economy of intelligence is intensely physical.
So our mission today is to unpack that, how this relentless hunger for computing power from AI.
This exponential demand.
Has basically shattered the old way of doing things, the traditional data center model. It's obsolete.
Totally. We're in the middle of this, multi-trillion dollar reconfiguration of global infrastructure.
Yeah.
Building these huge new industrial compute hubs.
AI factories.
That's the term, yeah. And here's the central conflict, the thing you really need to grasp.
Okay.
This soaring demand for performance. It's smashing head-on into hard physical limits, real-world limits.
Like what?
Like power grids that are already strained, like water resources, like the actual minerals we need to build the hardware.
Right. You can't just write more code to solve a grid bottleneck.
Precisely. Yeah. Or a shortage of cobalt. These are the non-negotiable boundaries. They define the future of AI, whether we like it or not.
That really sets the stage. So let's dig into that first pillar. Processing power, and this idea of the AI factory. Why the name change? Why not just call them data center?
Well, the name change signals a fundamental shift in function. It's vital.
Okay.
A traditional data center. Think of it like a storage depot or a delivery service for apps.
Running websites, handling transactions, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Scalable delivery of distinct applications. They were built around the CPU, the central processing unit, because a lot of the work was waiting, you know? Waiting for input output, not doing massive calculations.
And those older facilities, they had pretty manageable power needs, right?
Relatively speaking, yes. We were talking maybe 10, perhaps 15 kilowatts per server rack. That was the standard range.
Manageable.
Yeah. 10, 15 kilowatt was comfortable. You could cool it with air, design the buildings in a pretty standard way.
But the AI factory is different.
Completely different beast. It's built for industrial scale production of intelligence. Massive parallel processing is the name of the game.
And that means specialized chips.
Absolutely. The CPU isn't the king anymore. It's all about accelerators. Yeah. GPUs, TPUs, Google's custom chips, Microsoft's, Amazon's. Specialized silicon designed for these parallel tasks.
And this specialization, this power, leads directly to a huge physics problem. Extreme density. Why pack so much power into one rack?
It comes down to the nature of AI training. You need to perform just a mind-boggling number of parallel calculations, floating point operations to train these huge models.
So how big a leap are we talking about from those 10, 15 kilowatt racks?
Okay, get this. AI racks today routinely demand anywhere from 40 kilowatts up to 130 kilowatts.
Wait, 130? That's
and the roadmaps are projecting 250 kilowatts per rack by 2030.
That's insane. That's more than a tenfold increase from the old standard.
Exactly. It's a step change, not an incremental upgrade. And that invalidates so much legacy infrastructure. The bottleneck isn't power delivery anymore. It's heat removal.
Okay, hold on. If an old data center only needed 15 kilowatts per rack, why couldn't they just, you know, pull more power into the building, upgrade the feed? Is the physical constraint really the cooling inside the rack space?
That's a fantastic question, and it gets right to the core of why this is an architectural shift. Yes, you could bring more power to the building's doorstep,
right.
But the entire internal system, the air conditioning units, the ductwork, the airflow design under the raised floors, it was all engineered to dissipate maybe 15 kilowatts of waste heat from that specific rack footprint.
Ah, I see.
If you suddenly try to cram a 100 kilowatt rack into that same space, the air simply can't carry away enough heat fast enough.
The temperature skyrockets.
Instantly, you'd hit thermal limits, and the equipment would just shut down to protect itself. You can't just tweak the AC. You need a fundamentally different way to get the heat out. That's why liquid cooling becomes mandatory. It's a physics limit of air.
So specialized chips demand density. Density demands massive power, and that power generates heat that forces a total rethink of the physical building.
You got it. And tightly coupled to that processing power is the communication layer, the network.
And this isn't just about moving data from A to B anymore, is it?
Not at all. When you're training a model with, say, trillions of parameters, you have to split that workload across thousands, maybe tens of thousands of GPUs.
Oh.
All those GPUs need to constantly exchange results, synchronize their calculations almost instantly with incredibly low latency.
So the network becomes part of the computer.
That's a great way to put it. It's essentially an extension of the compute layer itself. It's not just plumbing anymore, it's part of the brain.
And standard Ethernet, even the faster versions, like 100 gigabits per second, that's just not good enough. Too slow, too much delay.
The latency is the killer.
Wow.
Even microseconds of delay matter here.
Really, microseconds.
Think about it. If one GPU finishes its piece of work and has to wait even a tiny fraction of a second for data from its neighbor, multiply that wait time by thousands of GPUs over hundreds or thousands of hours of training.
The inefficiency adds up massively. Wasted time, wasted energy.
Exactly. Standard networking protocols like TCP/IP have overhead. Software processing, packet handling delays, it all accumulates. That's why the industry shifted so hard towards specialized fabric.
Like InfiniBand.
InfiniBand is a big one, yes. And also advanced Ethernet protocols like RoCD, that stands for RDMA over Converged Ethernet.
RDMA.
Remote Direct Memory Access. That's the key.
What does that actually let you do?
It allows one GPU to directly access the memory of another GPU across the network, completely bypassing the main CPU and the operating system's network stack.
Cutting out the middlemen.
Precisely. It slashes latency dramatically. We're talking going from maybe hundreds of microseconds down to potentially sub-nanosecond levels for some operations. And the speeds are incredible. We're at 400 gigabits per second per link now, heading rapidly towards 800, 1600, even 3200 GBPs is on the roadmap.
So that speed and low latency allows thousands of chips to work together, almost like a single giant processor.
That's the goal. A unified, massively parallel computational engine. Without that fabric, large model training just wouldn't be feasible at the scale we see today.
Okay, so we have the processors, the high-speed links between them. What about getting the actual data to the processor? Storage has to keep up too, right?
Absolutely critical. If those incredibly powerful, incredibly expensive GPUs are sitting idle, waiting for data, well, that's a huge waste of capital and energy.
I/O starvation, they call it.
Exactly. You have to prevent I/O starvation. And traditional storage architectures, they often can't keep pace.
What was wrong with the old way? Central storage arrays, network attached storage.
Too slow, too much latency, often bottlenecked by general purpose network protocols.
Ah.
For AI factories, you need something much faster, much more parallel. We're seeing a move towards disaggregated storage.
Disaggregated, what does that mean practically?
It means the storage isn't necessarily inside the same physical box as the compute nodes. The storage capacity is pooled separately,
Okay.
but connected to the compute nodes via these extremely high-speed network fabrics, often using technologies like NVMe over fabrics. NVMe is the protocol designed for fast flash storage.
So faster connections to faster storage.
And massive parallelism. We see huge deployments of parallel file systems. Think things like Lustre or BGFS. These systems allow thousands of compute nodes to all read and write data simultaneously to the same shared storage pool.
At incredible speeds.
Aggregate speeds measured in terabytes per second. You need that kind of throughput to constantly feed the training data to thousands of hungry GPUs during training, and also to serve up data quickly for inference tasks.
This tight integration, the dense chips, the ultra-fast networking, the high-performance storage, it really highlights the advantage held by companies that control the whole stack, doesn't it? Which brings us to NVIDIA.
Ah, yes, NVIDIA's moat. It's formidable.
And it's not just that their GPUs are good.
Well, their hardware is definitely top tier, no question. But their real enduring dominance comes from the full stack they offer, and the anchor of that stack is the CUDA software ecosystem.
CUDA. Explain why that's such a powerful lock-in. Why is it so hard for developers or companies to switch away from NVIDIA?
Okay, imagine you're an AI engineer or researcher. You've likely spent years developing your models, your code, your workflows using NVIDIA's tools.
Right.
You're using their specialized libraries like cuDNN for deep learning, maybe other libraries for scientific computing, all optimized for CUDA. You know the debugging tools, you're part of the community, you leverage a vast amount of existing CUDA code.
Familiar territory.
Deeply familiar. Now, if your company decides to switch to a competitor's chip, maybe a Google TPU or an AWS Trainium chip, you can't just run your existing code.
You have to rewrite it.
You potentially have to rewrite or port years of highly optimized code. you lose access to those specific NVIDIA libraries that give you performance boosts. You have to learn a whole new software stack, new tools, new ways of debugging.
That sounds incredibly expensive and time-consuming.
It is. The switching cost isn't just the price of the new hardware. It's the engineering time, the retraining, the potential delays in getting your models to market. That deep software integration and the established ecosystem, that's the real competitive moat. It's incredibly sticky.
Which makes perfect sense why the big cloud providers, AWS, Google, Microsoft, are fighting back so hard with their own custom silicon.
Exactly. They are NVIDIA's biggest customer, spending billions on GPUs. But they are also desperately trying to reduce that dependency.
It's a classic case of wanting to control your own supply chain.
And gain more control over costs and performance. By developing their own chips, like AWS with Trainium for training and Inferentia for inference, Google with their TPUs, Microsoft with Maya and Cobalt, they achieve a couple of key things.
Cost reduction, obviously.
That's a big one. Cutting out the middleman, NVIDIA, directly impacts their bottom line. But just as importantly, maybe even more so.
Optimization.
Yes. They can design and optimize that silicon specifically for their own cloud infrastructure, their own software stacks, their internal workloads, maybe even for specific types of AI models they see their customers running.
So potentially better performance for their specific use cases than a general purpose GPU.
That's the goal. So it's about cost, yes, but it's also about performance tuning, and ultimately about controlling the entire vertical stack of AI production, from the silicon design all the way up to the application layer. This is a battle for control of the fundamental means of AI production.
Okay, so we've established this massive need for specialized processing, networked in a new way, fed by high-speed storage. Now let's pivot to what you called the ultimate limiting factor. The resource that this whole density shift has made the primary bottleneck.
Electrical power.
Let's talk about the scale. You called it an energy tsunami. Quantify that for us.
We have to grasp the numbers because they are truly staggering and they're putting real strain on national power grids. The International Energy Agency, the IEA, has projections.
Okay.
They estimate that the combined electricity use of data centers, AI, and crypto mining worldwide, it's set to potentially more than double just between 2022 and 2026.
Double? From what baseline?
From around 460 terawatt hours in 2022, possibly exceeding 1,000 terawatt hours by 2026.
1,000 terawatt hours, just to put that in perspective for listeners. That's roughly the entire annual electricity consumption of Japan.
An entire industrialized nation's worth of power consumption just for this sector's growth in a few years. And AI is the main driver behind that surge.
How much more energy does an AI workload actually use compared to, say, traditional computing?
It's fundamentally different. An AI training cluster, for example, can consume something like 7 to 8 times more energy than a typical cloud computing workload, like running virtual machines or databases.
7 to 8 times more.
And that's just for training. The costs continue, maybe even grow, when the model is actually being used day to day.
That's the inference cost, right? Running the model to answer queries, generate text, etc.
Exactly. As these AI systems get embedded everywhere in search engines, office software, consumer apps, the total energy needed just to run them for inference becomes enormous.
We've all heard that stat about a single ChatGPT query using way more energy than a Google search.
Yeah, figures suggest nearly 10 times the energy, and it makes sense if you think about it.
Why is that?
Generating a complex, multi-sentence, novel answer requires vastly more computation, more floating point operations per result than just retrieving and ranking existing web pages.
Right, it's creating something new versus finding something old.
Precisely. So as AI adoption explodes globally, this inference energy demand is a huge factor. In the U.S., projections show data center electricity use climbing from maybe 4 or 5% of the national total now toward potentially 12% or more by 2028.
That level of consumption, concentrated in these dense AI factories, generates immense amounts of waste heat. Which brings us back to that architectural shift we talked about, the cooling imperative.
Yes, air cooling is, for all intents and purposes, obsolete for high-density AI.
It's just not physically capable.
It's a non-starter. Once you push past that, say, 40 kilowatts per rack threshold, the physics just don't work anymore. Air is a terrible medium for transferring large amounts of heat efficiently.
But liquids are much better.
Dramatically better. Liquids can transport heat something like 3,000 times more effectively than air. So liquid cooling isn't just a fancy option anymore. It's a fundamental requirement for managing the heat load in these AI factories.
Okay, let's get a bit technical on the methods. The industry seems to be settling on two main approaches. Tell us about direct-to-chip cooling first. That seems to be becoming quite common.
Direct-to-chip, or D2C, is becoming the workhorse. Think of it like targeted water cooling, but for servers.
Like in a high-end gaming PC, but scaled up massively.
Kind of, yeah. You mount these sealed metal plates, cold plates, directly onto the hottest components, the GPUs, the CPUs, maybe even memory modules.
Okay.
Inside these cold plates are tiny microchannels. A coolant fluid, usually a mix of highly purified water and glycol to prevent freezing and corrosion, is pumped through these channels.
Absorbing the heat right at the source.
Exactly. It picks up the heat directly from the chip, carries it out of the server rack through flexible tubing and manifolds, and then that heated liquid goes to a larger facility-level heat exchanger where the heat is finally rejected.
And this works well for?
It's very practical and efficient for densities in that, say, 40 kilowatts up to maybe 100 kilowatts per rack range. And a side benefit is it can reduce the need for large amounts of water evaporation at the building level, which helps with water consumption.
But for the really extreme racks, pushing over 100 kilowatts, maybe towards that 250 kilowatt future, We hear about immersion cooling. That sounds pretty wild.
It is pretty wild, but it's the ultimate solution for maximum heat density. Instead of just cooling the chips, you literally submerge the entire server, or sometimes the whole rack, into a bath of special fluid.
You just dunk the electronics, the one that short everything out.
That's the key. It's a dielectric fluid. It looks like water or oil, but it doesn't conduct electricity at all. So the components can be fully submerged and operate safely.
Okay. And there are different types of immersion.
Right. Two main types. There's single-phase immersion, where the dielectric fluid stays liquid. It circulates around the components, absorbs the heat, and then gets pumped out to be cooled externally, similar in principle to D2C, but bathing everything.
And the other type?
Two-phase immersion. This is even more efficient, especially for extreme heat loads.
How does that work?
You use a specialized dielectric fluid that has a very low boiling point. When this fluid touches the hot spots on the GPUs or CPUs, it actually boils.
It boils. Inside the tank?
Yes. It turns from liquid into vapor right at the chip surface. This phase change, liquid to gas, absorbs a tremendous amount of heat energy, much more than just warming up a liquid.
Latent heat of vaporization, right?
Exactly. So the vapor then rises naturally within the sealed tank until it hits a condenser coil, basically a cool surface, often carrying facility water located at the top.
And it turns back into liquid.
It condenses back into liquid and simply drips back down onto the components, creating this continuous, passive, gravity-driven cooling cycle. It's incredibly efficient for handling those 100 kilowatt plus racks, but the fluids themselves are quite specialized and can be expensive.
That's incredible engineering. But all this focus on power density, specialized cooling, it leads to the biggest logistical hurdle of all, doesn't it? Actually finding a place to build these AI factories.
Yeah.
Site selection.
It has completely flipped the script on site selection.
How so? What used to be most important?
Traditionally, you'd look for things like proximity to fiber optic networks, maybe low real estate costs, tax incentives. Nope. Now, number one, two, and three on the checklist is, can I get power? And not just power, but hundreds of megawatts, sometimes gigawatts, of reliable high voltage power.
So the data center is effectively becoming a major industrial power consumer, like a giant factory or smelter.
Precisely. It's becoming a core piece of the energy infrastructure itself. And this intense, concentrated demand in specific locations is putting enormous strain on local utility grids around the world.
What are the real-world consequences of that strain? Where are we seeing bottlenecks?
We're seeing massive queues just to get connected to the grid. In the big established data center hubs, think Northern Virginia, which is the world's largest market, or places like Dublin and Ireland, Singapore, Frankfurt. The utility simply cannot build new substations and high-voltage transmission lines fast enough.
So companies are ready to build, but they literally can't plug in.
Exactly. They're facing wait times of up to 4 years in some of these key regions just to get their power connection approved and built. That kind of delay can kill a multi-billion dollar project. The physical utility infrastructure is the hard bottleneck.
A four-year wait is just not acceptable for these hyperscale companies moving at lightning speed. So what are they doing about it?
They're making a major strategic shift. They are effectively becoming energy companies themselves, integrating backwards into the power sector.
How are they doing that? Buying power plants?
Not quite buying coal plants, but they are becoming the dominant players in securing new clean energy generation.
Through power purchase agreements, PPAs.
Yes. Data center operators are now, by far, the biggest corporate buyers of renewable energy globally. In 2024, estimates suggest they were responsible for something like 43% of all the corporate clean energy PPAs signed worldwide.
So they're basically funding the construction of new wind and solar farms just by guaranteeing they'll buy the power.
That's a huge part of it. Their massive, predictable demand makes these renewable projects financeable.
But wait, signing a PPA for solar power doesn't help you run your data center at midnight, right? Solar and wind are intermittent. Data centers need power 24/7.
You've hit on the critical challenge. That brings us to the concept of 247 carbon-free energy, or CFE.
Okay, what's the difference between a standard PPA and 247 CFE?
A standard annual PPA basically means over the course of a year, you bought enough renewable energy certificates, or RECs, somewhere on the grid to match your total annual consumption.
Like balancing your checkbook at the end of the year.
Kind of, but it doesn't guarantee that the specific electrons you were using at, say, 8 p.m. on a Tuesday came from a clean source. If the wind wasn't blowing and the sun wasn't shining near your data center at that moment, you were likely pulling power from a fossil fuel plant on the local grid.
Even if you bought solar RECs from another state.
Right. 2047 CFE is much stricter. The goal is to match your actual consumption hour by hour with clean energy generated in the same grid region where you're consuming it.
So, ensuring the power you use right now is actually coming from a clean source nearby.
That's the ideal. It requires a much more sophisticated approach to energy procurement and grid management. You can't just rely on intermittent renewables.
You need baseload power. Clean baseload power.
Exactly. Power sources that can run reliably around the clock, regardless of the weather. And this is driving a big shift in investment.
Towards what kind of sources?
We're seeing serious interest and investment from tech giants in next-generation nuclear power, specifically small modular reactors, or SMRs.
Nuclear, yeah.
Yes. Microsoft, for example, has been publicly exploring agreements with SMR developers. SMRs promise reliable, carbon-free baseload power, potentially scalable, and maybe even co-locatable near data center campuses eventually.
What else besides nuclear?
There's also significant investment going into enhanced geothermal energy, tapping deeper, more consistent heat from the earth, and exploring things like green hydrogen-powered fuel cells, potentially for backup or even primary power in some scenarios.
Wow. When tech companies start signing deals for nuclear reactors.
You know, the game has fundamentally changed. The line between tech company and energy infrastructure player is getting very, very blurry.
That's a massive strategic shift. Okay, so once you've secured the power, you need to connect these AI factories and distribute the intelligence. Let's move to section 3. Communication and storage, but with a focus on the network structure and increasingly the geopolitics involved.
Right. That architectural split we talked about earlier, the powerful processors needing specialized networks, is also driving a geographical split in how the internet infrastructure is being built out.
Driven by the different needs of AI workloads.
Exactly. And latency requirements, it's leading to this kind of dual architecture.
Okay, what are the two parts? Let's start with the big hubs.
First, you have these massive centralized hubs. These are the true AI factories. We're talking huge campuses, needing hundreds of megawatts, maybe even pushing towards a gigawatt of power eventually.
Where are they being built?
They tend to cluster in regions with stable, abundant power, and good fiber connectivity. Think Northern Virginia, the so-called FLAPD markets in Europe, Frankfurt, London, Amsterdam, Paris, Dublin, maybe parts of the Nordics.
And what kind of AI work happens there?
This is where the really heavy lifting gets done. Primarily, the massive training runs for foundation models. These can take weeks or months, so slightly higher network latency, maybe 50, 100 milliseconds to connect to them, is acceptable because the jobs are so long running.
Okay, so giant centralized training centers. What's the other part of the architecture?
The decentralized edge, or inference hubs.
Why do we need those if the central hubs are so powerful?
Latency, pure and simple. The speed of light is the ultimate limit.
For real-time applications.
Exactly. If you're building AI applications that need to react instantly, think autonomous vehicles, real-time translation, maybe remote surgery using robotics, personalized AI agents interacting with you, you need incredibly low latency. single-digit milliseconds.
And you just can't get that if the data has to travel hundreds of thousands of miles to a central hub and back.
Correct. Physics dictates you have to push the computation, specifically the inference part, running the already trained model physically closer to where the users or the sensors are, closer to the population centers.
So smaller data centers sprinkled closer to cities?
Essentially, yes. Smaller facilities, maybe edge data centers or points of presence, designed to host these inference workloads and provide those ultra-fast response times. It creates this mandatory hub-and-spoke topology for the AI-powered internet.
This whole network, both the hubs and the edge, relies on physical cables, right? The backbones of the internet.
Absolutely. It all runs on fiber optic cables. Undersea submarine cables linking continents, terrestrial fiber routes crossing landmasses. These are immense strategic assets.
And potential vulnerabilities, choke points.
Huge vulnerabilities. We saw a stark reminder recently with the damage to several submarine cables in the Red Sea, a critical route connecting Europe and Asia near the Suez Canal.
Disruptions like that can impact connectivity for millions.
For entire regions, potentially, whether it's accidental damage from ship anchors, natural disasters like earthquakes near landing points, or even deliberate sabotage in a geopolitical conflict, the physical fragility of these communication links is a major concern.
And the choke points aren't just the cables themselves, right? What about the places where all the data converges?
You mean Internet Exchange Points, or IXPs? Yes. Places like DECIX in Frankfurt, AMSIX in Amsterdam, LINX in London. These are massive physical locations where hundreds of networks interconnect. They are critical hubs, but also potential single points of failure if disrupted.
But perhaps the biggest physical choke point of all relates back to the processing layer. The actual manufacturing of the advanced chips.
Ah, yes. This is arguably the most critical geopolitical vulnerability in the entire tech ecosystem today.
The concentration in Taiwan.
Over 90% of the world's most advanced logic semiconductors, the cutting-edge GPUs and processors needed for these AI factories are manufactured in Taiwan, primarily by one company, TSMC.
90%.
It's an astonishing concentration. Any disruption to Taiwan, whether it's a geopolitical crisis, a major earthquake, even a drought affecting water supply for the fabs, would send immediate shockwaves through the global economy. It would halt the AI build-out in its tracks.
And this extreme vulnerability, this concentration risk, is directly fueling that trend you mentioned, the splinternet, the geopolitical fragmentation.
Absolutely. Techno-nationalism is overriding pure market efficiency now. Countries are realizing they can't afford to be so dependent on potentially unstable global supply chains for such critical technology.
So governments are stepping in.
Massively. Look at the U.S. CHIPS and Science Act, $52.7 billion in subsidies, specifically aimed at reshoring advanced semiconductor manufacturing to the United States. That's a direct response to the Taiwan risk.
And Europe.
Europe has its own EU Chips Act, similarly trying to boost domestic production. And then you have broader regulatory frameworks like the EU AI Act, which, while focused on governance, also creates a distinct regulatory block aiming for digital sovereignty.
It feels like the world is splitting into competing tech spheres.
It really is coalescing around maybe three major paradigms or blocks.
Okay, what are they?
First, you have the market-driven U.S. bloc, still largely led by the hyperscalers, focused on rapid innovation, pushing the performance frontier, but now with significant government backing through subsidies to build more resilient domestic supply chains.
Second,
the state-centric China bloc. China is aggressively pursuing technological self-sufficiency as a national security imperative. They're pouring resources into domestic chip champions like Huawei with their Ascend AI chips, SMIC for manufacturing, trying to decouple entirely from Western technology in critical areas. Data sovereignty and state control are paramount.
And the third block, you mentioned the EU.
Yes, the regulatory EU block.
Yeah.
Europe might not have the leading edge chip fabs or the giant AI labs on the same scale as the US or China, but it wields immense power through its market size and its focus on regulation.
The Brussels effect.
Exactly. By setting stringent rules on things like data privacy, GDPR, and now AI safety and ethics, the AI Act, the EU effectively exports its standards globally. Companies wanting access to the huge European market have to comply, making EU regulations a de facto global benchmark. It's about setting the rules of the game.
Fascinating. Right. Underlying all this hardware, the chips, the cables, the cooling systems, is an even more fundamental physical layer, the actual materials they're made from, The Mineral Foundation.
Yes, we can't forget this. The entire glittering edifice of AI rests on a foundation of mundane but utterly essential earth metals.
What are the key ones we should be thinking about?
We're talking about critical minerals, lithium and cobalt for batteries, which are crucial for stabilizing power grids with renewables, rare earth elements for high-performance magnets in motors and electronics, gallium and germanium, which are vital for advanced semiconductors and fiber optics. Copper, of course, is needed everywhere for wiring.
And the concern isn't just digging them out of the ground, is it? You've highlighted the midstream as the real choke point.
That's where the concentration risk becomes acute. Mining happens in many places, but the complex processing and refining needed to turn raw ores into the ultra-pure materials required for high-tech manufacturing. That capability is heavily concentrated.
Concentrated where?
Predominantly in China. For example, China controls something like 90% or more of the global refining capacity for rare earth elements. For cobalt processing, it's around 70%. Similar dominance exists for gallium, germanium, graphite.
And this concentration gives enormous leverage.
It absolutely does. It allows this dominance to be, frankly, weaponized through things like export controls. We saw China impose restrictions on gallium and germanium exports recently.
What's the impact of that?
It can immediately restrict supply, drive up prices, and potentially slow down manufacturing of critical components like advanced chips or defense technologies in rival nations. It highlights the fragility and forces other countries to invest billions in diversifying and building their own, often less economical, refining capacity. It's a high-stakes, multi-decade race for mineral security.
This intricate web of physical dependencies, power, cooling, minerals, brings us to our final section, sustainability and the economic trilemma, the inescapable costs of this growth. Let's start with a resource we haven't focused on as much, but which is crucial, water.
Yes, the water footprint of data centers, especially AI factories, is significant and often overlooked.
Why do they need so much water? Is it just for cooling?
Primarily, yes. While direct liquid cooling methods like D2C can reduce water use at the rack level, the most common and often most cost-effective way to reject the heat from the entire building still involves evaporative cooling towers.
Like the ones you see at power plants.
Exactly. These towers use water evaporation to dissipate large amounts of heat into the atmosphere. A medium-sized data center using this method can consume a startling amount of water, potentially equivalent to 1,000 homes annually, maybe up to 110 million gallons per year.
And AI makes this worse.
Definitely. The sheer energy density of AI workloads translates directly to more heat-needing rejection, thus more water consumption if using evaporative cooling. There was an estimate that training the original GPC-3 model alone required something like 700,000 liters of fresh water.
That's a huge amount, especially if these facilities are being built in water-stressed areas.
That's the major tension. Places like Arizona, a major data center hub, are facing severe water shortages. So you have this direct competition between the thirst of these AI factories and the needs of agriculture and residents.
What's the industry doing about it?
Tech giants are making ambitious pledges, aiming to be water positive by 2030, meaning they replenish more fresh water to local watersheds than they consume through their operations. But achieving that requires significant investment in water recycling technologies, shifting to less water-intensive cooling methods, like air-cooled chillers, even if less efficient, or sourcing water from non-potable sources. It's a major operational and environmental challenge.
This water issue fits into the broader theme you mentioned, the sustainability paradox.
Mm-hmm.
The technology keeps getting more efficient, but the overall impact keeps growing.
That's the classic Jevons paradox, or rebound effect, playing out on a massive scale. We absolutely have to give the industry credit for incredible engineering achievements in efficiency.
Like the PUE metric.
Right, power usage effectiveness. It measures how much of the total power drawn by a data center actually reaches the IT equipment versus being used for cooling, lighting, power conversion losses, etc. A perfect PUE is 1.00.
And what are typical PUEs now?
The industry average used to be maybe 1.5 or higher, meaning 50% overhead. But the leading hyperscalers today report amazing fleet-wide PUEs, often below 1.2. Google has even reported 1.009 for some periods. That means only 9% overhead. It's achieved through optimized airflow, hot-cold aisle containment, liquid cooling adoption, efficient power supplies. It's truly remarkable engineering.
So they're using the power they draw incredibly efficiently. Yeah. But
that efficiency game is being completely swamped by the sheer explosive growth in the total amount of computing being demanded, especially by AI.
The Jevons paradox. Making something more efficient makes it cheaper so people use more of it.
Exactly. It's like inventing a car that gets 500 miles per gallon. That's great. But if that efficiency encourages everyone to drive 10 times as much because fuel is effectively cheaper per mile, the total gasoline consumption might still go up.
So despite the PUE improvements, the total energy and resource footprint of the sector is still skyrocketing.
That's what the IEA projections show, doubling energy demand by 2026 despite ongoing efficiency gains. It tells us that technological efficiency alone, while crucial, cannot solve the environmental impact problem. Mm-hmm. We also need to address the demand side and accelerate the transition to clean energy sources fundamentally.
This reality, the growing resource demands, the supply chain fragility, makes the idea of a circular economy absolutely essential, doesn't it? Especially for the hardware lifecycle.
It has to be central to the strategy going forward. We simply cannot sustain a purely linear extract, make, use, dispose model for this level of infrastructure build-out, given the resource constraints and environmental costs.
So what does a circular approach look like for data center hardware?
It involves a hierarchy of strategies. The first priority is reuse. Can older servers, networking gear, or storage arrays, maybe after 3 to 5 years in a cutting-edge AI role, be repurposed for less demanding tasks? Perhaps for standard enterprise workloads, backups, or in secondary markets? Maximize the useful life first.
Okay, reuse first. What's next?
Refurbishment and remanufacturing. This involves taking used equipment, testing it, replacing worn components, maybe upgrading some parts, and restoring it to a certified, like, new condition for resale. This keeps the core asset with all its embedded materials and energy in productive use for much longer.
And only after reuse and refurbishment comes recycling.
Ideally, yes. Recycling, or what's sometimes called urban mining, is the final step when the equipment truly reaches the end of its functional life. The focus here is on recovering those valuable and critical materials.
Is recycling electronics actually effective? Can you get much back?
It can be incredibly effective, especially compared to primary mining. For example, recovering gold from printed circuit boards can be anywhere from 40 to potentially 800 times more efficient in terms of yield per ton of material processed than mining raw gold ore.
Wow.
And it's vital for reclaiming not just precious metals like gold and palladium, but also copper, aluminum, and crucially, those critical minerals like rare earths, cobalt, indium. Reducing our reliance on those fragile, geographically concentrated primary supply chains we talked about.
But you mentioned a feedstock gap. Recycling sounds great, but it doesn't solve the immediate problem, does it?
No, it's not a silver bullet for the current supply crunch. The issue is timing. The AI industry needs vast quantities of new state-of-the-art hardware right now, but the servers being decommissioned today are maybe 3 to 5 years old.
So the materials locked up in today's retiring servers aren't necessarily the same type or quantity needed for tomorrow's cutting-edge chips.
Partly that, but also just the volume. You can't recycle enough 5-year-old servers today to provide all the raw materials needed to build the millions of brand new advanced GPUs required for the AI factories being constructed tomorrow. There's a lag.
So primary mining and securing those mineral supply chains remained absolutely critical for the next decade or so.
Yes. While we absolutely must build out the circular economy infrastructure for the long term, primary extraction will remain essential to meet the immediate, massive demand for new hardware for at least the next 5-10 years. Recycling closes the loop eventually, but doesn't eliminate the need for new resources in the short to medium term.
Okay, let's pivot one last time to the financial implications of all these physical shifts, these resource constraints, these geopolitical games, the economic value migration. Where is the money flowing in this AI era?
The value is clearly migrating. It's shifting away from the sort of generic, commoditized cloud offerings, the basic infrastructure as a service, IaaS, like renting a standard virtual machine and moving decisively towards specialized, high-performance, integrated AI infrastructure.
So the premium is on.
The premium is on securing access to the scarce resources,
yeah.
The GPUs, the high bandwidth networking like InfiniBand, the high density data center space with advanced liquid cooling, and the reliable power needed to run it all. That's where the bottleneck is, and that's where the pricing power lies right now. Analysis from firms like Goldman Sachs suggests this foundational infrastructure layer is capturing the lion's share of the initial economic value generated by the AI boom.
And this shift is fundamentally changing the nature of AI companies themselves, isn't it? Turning research labs into something else entirely.
It really is. They're becoming incredibly capital-intensive infrastructure firms. You used the analogy of utility barons earlier, and it's quite apt.
How so?
Look at companies like OpenAI or xAI. They started, conceptually, as software and research outfits. But their ability to actually deploy and scale their models now depends entirely on securing massive amounts of physical compute infrastructure.
Which costs billions.
Tens, potentially hundreds of billions. Think about OpenAI's reported Stargate project, a plan for a dedicated AI supercomputer potentially costing up to $500 billion, built in partnership with Microsoft, likely requiring its own dedicated power source. Or xAI's plans for its Colossus supercomputer.
These aren't software project budgets. These are national infrastructure project budgets.
Exactly. They are becoming energy and infrastructure companies that also happen to develop algorithms. Their competitive advantage isn't just the cleverness of their code anymore. It's their ability to finance, procure, and deploy the physical means of AI production processing, power, networking, storage faster and more reliably than anyone else.
So this whole deep dive has really stripped away the hype and shown that the AI economy isn't some abstract digital cloud. It's built on concrete, silicon, copper, water, and power lines.
That was the goal, to get down to the physical bedrock. And we've seen how these four foundational pillars dictate the landscape. Processing means GPUs, specialized accelerators, and the AI factory design. Power means extreme density, liquid cooling, and the desperate hunt for gigawatts of reliable, clean energy. Communication now means ultra-low latency fabrics becoming part of the compute itself. And storage needs high-performance parallel systems while the whole thing rests on fragile mineral supply chains.
So if you're trying to understand the strategic chessboard of AI for the next decade, what's the single most important takeaway?
It's that the abstract world of algorithms and intelligence is now irrevocably chained to the physical world. The limits are physics, geology, and geopolitics. The future of AI is inseparable from the future of our energy grids, our water resources, and our ability to manage complex global supply chains for fundamental materials. This isn't just tech anymore. It's heavy industry and utilities.
Which leads to a final, maybe provocative thought to leave our listeners with. If the AI models themselves start becoming more similar, maybe even commoditized, where does the real, lasting competitive advantage lie?
That's the multi-trillion dollar question, isn't it? But based on everything we've discussed, the most decisive, long-term competitive moat in the AI era might not actually be the smartest algorithm or the biggest data set. It might simply be the ability to secure a guaranteed, long-term, affordable supply of clean, reliable baseload power and the physical infrastructure needed to turn those electrons into intelligence.
Control the power. Control the future of AI.
It's increasingly looking that way. Control over electrons might ultimately be more valuable than control over lines of code.
A powerful note to end on, indeed. Thank you so much for breaking down this incredibly complex physical foundation for us today.
My pleasure. It's a fascinating and crucial topic.